to episode 358 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Michael O'Malley,
Nadine Smith.
In today's episode, we'll be talking about movies that we saw this week in part one. And in part two, we will be kicking off our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with 1924's Greed. And what a kickoff it is. It is a whole lot of movie. Real quickly, head over to cinematary.com. We got a nice new review from Andrew Swafford of All Light Everywhere by Theo Anthony. We talked a little bit about it last week in the episode, but he has a review of that up, and then we have something coming up next week. So head over to the site and check that out. And if you missed our Feel Good Queer Movie series that just wrapped up last week, head over there and listen to those episodes. Those are all there on the podcast page. But I wanted to go ahead and jump into movies that we saw this week, and we got two new releases because we're going back to the movies, folks. We're going back to the movie theater. And I'm kind of
not with ours, Zach.
That's true. Ours was technically just Disney Plus,
which is a big gripe I have, honestly.
Oh, really? Well, would you like to start with that? You want to jump in on the new Pixar movie Luca, which was not in movie theaters but just in Disney Plus.
Yeah, unceremoniously dropped on Disney Plus too, to the point where many people who would I think normally be interested in Pixar movies kind of didn't realize that it existed.
I saw people talking about Luca and I thought it was a Pixar short film, like, I don't know, just the like name of it, because there's one called Lunar or
Luna, by the same director,
right? Okay.
And there's a sequence in this movie that like kind of references that movie.
Well, and also, so like Disney Plus has been doing that thing where, you know, they'll drop a movie and it'll make you pay that extra $30 or whatever for like the whole premiere. And they didn't even do that for this movie. They just like
neither Pixar movie Soul. They didn't do that with either. And
and Onward.
And I guess that, you know, take that for what you will about the relationship between Disney and its sub-studio Pixar. I don't exactly know what that's meant to communicate, except that I think that a lot of people didn't know this movie came out, or if it did come out, they didn't recognize that this was like a like flagship Pixar movie, which it is. And I really liked it a lot. I think a lot of people have seen it and thought like it was minor Pixar. You know, it doesn't like really swing for the fences emotionally. It doesn't have anything like wild, ambitious like world building or anything like that. It's a really low stakes, low key movie. And I think a lot of people have kind of, at least people that I've seen have maybe written it off as like, yeah, that was kind of fine, but like, I'm just moving on. But I think it's really good. It's super colorful. I guess like the plot is established like really quickly. Like this is an incredibly efficient movie as far as storytelling goes. Where like within the first five minutes, you've got like the whole premise of the movie, which is that there's like this Italian like coastal town where people live. And then off the shore, there's like sea people or sea monsters, as the land people call them. And when the land monsters or the sea monsters walk out of the water and cease to be wet, they look like people. And so these two little sea monster kids kind of steal away from their parents and go decide that they're going to live amongst the people of the village because they're really interested in land monsters, as
and
they call them.
And it's a quaint Italian town. Just, like, I would also go and like to go hang out there.
Yeah. Like, people are just eating gelato and doing triathlons with them. Middle leg is a bowl of spaghetti,
yeah.
So you know,
which is something we can talk about. Which, you know, like it's a little like, I remember when I was watching it, I was like, this a little offensive that like it's like, so we're gonna have a triathlon and there's gonna be biking and swimming and then you eat spaghetti, and I was like, this like, did you okay, like we're not gonna speak Italian other than when we're like insulting people, and I was like, all right,
yeah, it is the director is Italian. But definitely watching it, I was like, this feels like a joke Italian culture. I really liked it. I like the idea of Pixar being able to make movies that are really low stakes and don't have to be like medium defining events, which I think some people recoil at because they want every Pixar movie to be like, make them cry like an Up or something like that. And I love those movies too. But like, I like that the studio, maybe just by force of they're running out of ideas, I don't know, but like, their movies are kind of stopping being events and are, I would like that to happen because it kind of allows movies to be what they are rather than having to be like a cultural lightning rod. And I think Luca is maybe the best version of that. Like there's been other movies like maybe Onward or The Good Dinosaur that kind of also had that kind of feel of they're not trying to make this an event movie, and not trying to reinvent anything with it. And I think of all those, like Luca is the most successful, and I really like the story, which is just like a kind of very sweet friendship between the two sea monster kids. And it's like mostly them just palling around the Italian village. The ostensible like dramatic tension is that they'll be outed as sea monsters. And the town is like really afraid of them, afraid of sea monsters. And that eventually does come to a head, but like for the most part, that's a pretty low key, like almost comedic thing. And then the other stakes are that the parents are seeking after the kids, looking for their kids, but it's not like Finding Nemo or anything like that, where it's really kind of emotionally intense. It's more of like, a comedic set piece where the parents are keep like dousing kids in water to see if they'll turn back into sea monsters.
It's not even dousing. They're knocking kids into water. Like, yeah. They literally are just walking around, like, pushing kids into, like, fountains and stuff.
Yeah, like, the first kid that they see, they're like, could that be our kid? And he's sitting on, like, the edge of a pier or something. And they push him in. He's, like, eating ice cream. And they, like, push him in. And then later in the movie, like, you see that kid in the background just, like, do, like, a 180 when he sees these, like, insane adults again.
I love it. I immediately I was like, I love this movie. It just has like these adults walking into the town and kicking kids into water. Like, hell yeah, this is the best.
Yeah. So like in another Pixar movie, you could imagine this being like really kind of emotionally fraught, and like those can be really good. But like this movie like pointedly tries to like not make it emotionally fraught. And it's just like kind of low key, just vibing in the Italian town. And then the other thing I really like about this, and Zach, I know you mentioned this too, so maybe you could comment on it, but the animation is really good. It feels like, it's funny that you mentioned it being like, that you thought it was a short film, Nadine, because to me, this feels like some of the kind of like visual, like lightness of a Pixar short, you know, where it's not like trying to be super photorealistic or anything like that. And it's almost, it's really cartoony, almost like probably the most cartoony Pixar movie. The characters kind of look semi-flat, like they're trying to look kind of like almost like hand-drawn cartoons. If you think about like the thing that came to mind for me was two movies. One is the Peanuts movie from 5 or 6 years ago, and the other would be the Captain Underpants movie that DreamWorks put out. And both of those movies are using CGI to like make characters that were originally hand-drawn on a page kind of retain their same body shape and like movement in a 3D space. And like this movie kind of had that vibe to it, where a lot of it feels really quick and light on its feet and zippy and cartoony, and the characters are round and kind of spongy and elastic in ways that cartoons tend to be, and I really like that. I would also really like them just to actually make a cartoon, like a hand-drawn cartoon, but if they're gonna stick with CGI, I like this aesthetic. It's really fun to look at. It's super colorful and like I mentioned, super quick and doesn't feel really weighted with photorealism like a lot of Pixar movies do.
Yeah, it's you know, this is clearly, I think, their biggest attempt to kind of emulate Studio Ghibli. You know, like you mentioned with the plot, it's trying to be as plotless as I feel like a Western American animated movie can be, especially one that's like, you know, through the Walt Disney Company. But the thing that, you know, like the animation I thought was much more interesting to me than like the last two movies. Like Onward is pretty just kind of cut and paste in terms of like it's not trying to do anything interesting. And then Soul like has two animation styles like fighting each other, because like there is some like kind of abstract visual, like interesting visuals in when they go to like the dream Soul world of that movie. But then it has like the photorealistic New York City, like with the cartoony figures when they're in reality. And that's just, it's kind of the dissonance is strange to me. And this one feels much more like it like in a cohesive picture. The one thing that I was thinking of that was kind of my big takeaway, and I want to get your perspective on, Michael, is that it seems like Pixar, you mentioned like that Pixar used to kind of be like, they would have like these event films. Like you would have like a Toy Story movie or Finding Nemo or Up, or, you know, even the one we talked about a few months ago, Ratatouille, that they would come out and like it was supposed to have like this deep emotional resonance. And I saw it was kind of a, you know, a pithy response to I think it was an AV Club article that said, you know, what happened to Pixar, like, you know, and somebody was like, well, you grew up, that's what happened. But that's, you know, and I think that there's kind of some truth to that. But at the same time, I also think that Pixar's kind of gotten like, you know, in terms of story, it's kind of gotten in like this machine to a degree, you know, like this movie, it didn't really need this whole triathlon that it has. Like it has this triathlon and like this whole thing where they're trying to win this so they can get a Vespa. Like it doesn't need any of that. Like it, like you could literally just have these kids vibe in this town for an hour and a half and end the movie, and it would have been great, because whenever it's just them kind of chilling out together, it's a really fun movie. Like you have this vibrant animation, you have these really great characters. They're voiced by you have Jacob Tremblay, who voices Luca, and then Jack Dylan Grazer, who voices Alberto, which is the friend. And like they have like a nice chemistry on screen. Like it's like they're two interesting characters. But I think that it's like Pixar kind of has like this mold it has to follow. You have to have like these somewhat overbearing parents who overall love their child, but want the child, you know, but are also overbearing and want to kind of control the child. You have the child somewhat rebel to that, but also not maybe, you know, and try to kind of find, you know, forge their own path. You have to have kind of like a quirky third character that is thrown in there that, you know, might be voiced by Ellen DeGeneres, but maybe not, you know, we'll just kind of have somebody. And then you kind of have to have like this like emotional reckoning, like in the, you know, to kind of kick off the third act of this movie. And it, and like, so that, like all of that in Luca is like, none of it is bad, but like I was watching it and I was like, it's just so kind of formulaic to what I've seen from the last few Pixar movies, from, you know, the most recent Toy Story to the most, like the second Monsters Inc. to Onward to Soul. Like it just seems so formulaic in the way that it's like going by these emotional beats, because I think to your point, it feels like it's beholden to be like this life-affirming cultural event. And I'm just like, just make a fucking movie that's an hour and a half of these kids just vibing in this town. Like I think people will be fine with that. Like I don't think that's gonna be a giant deal, but it just feels like Pixar has like pigeonholed itself into being what we expect Pixar to be. And I think that to me, it just needs to accept that it needs to change, because it's just not that anymore. And that's because of a lot of things. It's not just Disney. I think it's also a lot of those creative forces have left, like Brad Bird and Andrew Stanton and people like that. But also just, I don't know, it doesn't have to be as big as it used to be.
Yeah, I saw that AV Club article, and also I had seen someone who screenshotted that tweet that was like, it's like you're not 10 anymore or something like that. And I guess or maybe it was you grew up or something. But and I guess my response to that, because I agree that there's certain things about Pixar that have kind of ossified. My response is less that you grew up and more that like the medium grew up. Because I think like in the moment, like the reason why a lot of those Pixar movies made such an impact was that they were doing things that like genuinely were new to CGI animation. You know, like something like WALL-E. Like that opening of WALL-E, where you've got like, you know, what is it, like 20 minutes or whatever with them just like going around with this cockroach or whatever. Like that was like genuinely something that no one would have thought to do, not just in like Western animation, but just like specifically with CGI, which And like with a lot of those like first, like the first decade, well, I don't know. However, I guess most people end like the golden age of Pixar at like Toy Story 3 or something like that. But like most of their movies through that period, like did some huge, like leap forward as far as like a storytelling thing that no one expected, or like some technological thing that was like really, you know, impressive, or both. And I think that like CG animation simply just got bigger, and Pixar wasn't the only fish in the pond anymore. And so like, for instance, the technological leap seemed to, or ceased to be like really, impressive. Like it's really impressive. You watch It's really impressive if you watch Finding Nemo and your only other option is, Shark Tale, right? Like, but it's a lot less impressive if you watch, you know, Soul and you have like, you know, there's like five or six studios in the United States alone making CGI films like that don't look like garbage. You know, they've actually like the rendering technology has gotten like widespread enough that like it's not the only, you know, the Pixar isn't the only people blazing forward. And then I think, yeah, you also have like, because of those early films making such a big impact, like a Pixar film became sort of a brand rather than like an artistic license. So like the people who talk about Luca, like, oh, it feels like minor Pixar. Like, I think they mean like, it doesn't make you feel really, you know, this really strong well of emotion because of some like really deeply resonant emotional undercurrent in the movie. And that's, I think, because that's the brand that Pixar consciously aspires to with a lot of its movies. And I don't know. I don't know if, I think I said at the beginning, like, I'm fine with Pixar movies just being minor. Like, I think that like it would be nice to have like Pixar like cease to try to be ambitious for a little while so that people could just get used to the idea of like Pixar being just another studio that does animated films, and these are fun, engaging, well-made animated films, rather than every one of these films has to be a leap forward for the medium. Because I think frankly like that's increasingly difficult to do just because the number of people, and also just that CGI animation is now like decades old, and you know, they're not leading the vanguard anymore. And I think that's fine. So,
I mean, I think that kind of the same thing happened with their former parent company, Apple, where when every release is a landmark, you get to a certain point where it's like, you're just like fiddling with knobs and like taking away the headphone jack for some reason because you have to put out something or do something new. And there's this sort of pressure of the big launch, the big release. And I also feel like that, in addition to just the brand, also like internally, I feel like there's just such a, the like aura of like the, you know, Pixar as a company, and that they have really like detailed and specific and rigorous like story development process and like a very specific understanding of what a Pixar movie is. And I think along with that sort of like changing expectations on the part of the audience, there's also like maybe they just need to like, you know, do not even in a like radical unexpected way, but it's sort of the way that you're talking about of like doing something more minor or more small. I feel like there's a way to just sort of like in doing smaller projects, like just vary more from the formula and like, you know, just make Pixar basically a just sort of label of quality rather than a label of like a specific kind of thing, which I think is kind of their problem. I mean, there've been times where they've like, I know that there was, you know, they were involved early on in the like Brad Bird San Francisco earthquake live action thing. Like that was going to be their first involvement in a live action project. And like, they were doing something with like Henry Selick at some point, like it didn't work out obviously, but they were sort of like doing, you know, looking at a stop motion kind of thing. And I feel like if they allow, you know, if they strayed even not into like other types of storytelling necessarily, but just kind of maybe slightly other, like, you know, other kinds of animation work or special effects work, it might loosen them up a little bit and lower some of those expectations.
I agree. And that's been my argument. I know a lot of people don't like The Good Dinosaur, but that was my big argument for The Good Dinosaur when it came out, is like, the specific like aesthetic of The Good Dinosaur felt like so dissonant that I thought it was like interesting that Pixar would do it, because Pixar is usually this really visually polished look, and The Good Dinosaur is frankly like really ugly looking in interesting ways. And like, I feel the same way about Luca, but not because it's ugly, but Luca is this smaller, kind of more self-contained project that seems like it's been allowed to breathe visually in a way that like, I can only think of like The Good Dinosaur doing. Like, I can't think of two other Pixar movies that feel as visually off format from like what Pixar normally does. And I think that that's encouraging to think about that, you know, these smaller projects could become places where, you know, the reins aren't as tight as far as like the Pixar machine goes. You know, like, I, if they're going to make Toy Story 5 or whatever, I'm sure that that will be very closely watched and whatever. But if there's like, you know, these kind of these movies that don't have like, you know, the brand of the company staked on them, are allowed to breathe a little bit, I think that would be really nice.
And one thing to kind of close up, it's worth mentioning, you know, in terms of like where Pixar goes next, that they also have a Monsters, Inc. like TV series, like a series that's going to be on Disney Plus, which is, you know, something different to them. And so that's another thing, you know, in terms of like what the company's going to be doing, just to kind of take a look at, because you know, it got into that cycle of like original movie, sequel, original movie, sequel, original movie. And like, I wonder if, you know, they, if, you know, depending on the success of that, they start kind of, in the fact that this was on Disney Plus, if they start kind of utilizing the streaming platform to, either, you know, make more interesting kind of types of movies like you're describing, Michael, or to just kind of continue to regurgitate kind of that Pixar, what people are expecting out of Pixar and that brand. So that's something they kind of monitor.
You know, that you mentioning the TV project does make me wonder, like, would they kind of farm out existing sort of properties and franchises as like TV shows and then keep the sort of new ideas to like original movies? I mean, I guess not everything would like lend itself to a series, but I feel like most of those Monsters, Inc., Toy Story, Cars, you know, yeah, the big franchises would lend themselves to TV.
No, exactly. And that would be my hope, is to like, yeah, let's make the movies that we make like interest and like let people like, you know, having new interesting voices and directors like doing stuff. But I don't know, that's the other thing as well, is that like, and I think this just comes into like movies in general, is like Pixar also, like, you probably have these directors who are coming to Pixar now who are coming there because they grew up with Toy Story and Monsters, Inc. and Bugs Life and stuff, and so they're coming to emulate that, and that always kind of, you know, you would like to, it's the whole like capitalism cycle of like, you think that it would like breed like innovation out of it, but really it's just they just kind of make their version of Toy Story or their version of the Pixar stuff that was meaningful to them when they were growing up. And so I'm concerned about that being a thing as well, because that's kind of what I saw with Onward, was it was kind of just like a movie by a director who really loved Pixar growing up and is just kind of trying to emulate that in an uninteresting way. So
yeah, I hope, I think Disney has said that they're not going to do the direct release of like the films of Pixar to Disney Plus anymore. Like, I think that they said Luca was the last one that they planned on doing that with, which I think is a good thing. Like, I am, you know, Onward, I didn't feel like I really missed anything by not seeing that in the theater, but both Soul and especially Luca were visually interesting enough that I was like, man, I really wish I had seen this in the theater. So I hope that if they kind of go down the streaming route, like, I mean, if it becomes like an outlet for experimentation, then that's cool, I guess. But I hope it doesn't like, you know, take away the interesting stuff from the big screen either.
Well, I hope that, you know, we don't sound super, because I really enjoyed Luca. Like, I recommend if you have it's Disney good. Plus, go check go it out. It. It's a fun one. But yeah, you can find it on Disney Plus. Nadine, I'm curious to hear about F9. Before you get into the movie, though, was this the first movie that you saw like in a theater, like as a return?
Yeah, the last movie I saw in a theater was First Cow. Last movie, First Cow. But it was like, you know, it was, it came out in New York for like a week before the pandemic, and it hadn't really come out anywhere else, and then came out, that came out on VOD later. And the last like actual like multiplex like movie that I went to was Sonic the Hedgehog. So anyways, I was, you know, very disappointed last year that I didn't get to see F9, which is the title of the ninth installment in the long running, still chugging along, constantly retrofitted Fast and Furious franchise. One of my favorites, obviously a huge mark for the works of Vin Diesel. And I think, like a lot of people, disappointed by the eighth installment, which was the first one, you know, made fully without the involvement of Paul Walker after his death. And so, you know, there were a lot of kind of high expectations on that movie, just of like, how is it going to fill this void of this relationship between Vin Diesel and Paul Walker, which is really like what's at the center of those movies. I mean, you know, you talk about just family in general with those movies, but it's really that relationship that is like the foundation of that sense of family. And you know, it wasn't, it maybe had some fun sequences and stuff, but I really don't remember very much about Fate of the Furious. Honestly, like, Vin Diesel had a kid with the Brazilian cop who died, I think. She died, yeah. And Charlize Theron is a hacker villain, and Scott Eastwood is in it for some reason. And also the big thing that I remember was that they didn't drink Corona. They drank Stella, which is a huge betrayal of core franchise mythology. Obviously, Corona, you know, is what they always drink. And so thankfully the Coronas are back this movie. Yeah, as well as Justin Lin is back, returning for the first time since Fast 6 after he was lured away by the false promise of Star Trek. Yeah, I liked Furious 7, which James Wan did, but F. Gary Gray, I think, is a fluke of a director, honestly. I really love Friday and Set It Off, but every other F. Gary Gray movie I've seen has been, like, nigh unwatchable sometimes. So Justin Lin is obviously, I think he gets talked about a lot as one of the best action filmmakers of the past decade or so, just pretty much off the strength of his Fast and Furious movies. You know, specifically people really, really love Fast 5 and Fast and Furious 6 and Tokyo Drift as well, which is my favorite in the series. And he's just kind of the person who is just like, as a director, he is like part of that family. And, you know, Vin Diesel is obviously a huge creative force as like the primary sort of producer. But Justin Lin is really, I think, the person who has like made Fast and Furious what it is, just in terms of like a certain kind of action filmmaking, which is just like very, I mean, basically the Fast and Furious movies, I mean, what they're known for at this point is taking the human body like as far as it can go without stepping into explicitly supernatural or super powered territory. It's basically just like, how can we use cars and various pieces of technology and human ingenuity to really, really, really push the limits of physics and gravity and all of that? And I think a mounting criticism against these movies is that with each installment, there is a disregard for basic physics. It just gets more and more ridiculous. And my kind of thing is like, it's been that way basically since the beginning. Like, the first ones are maybe not as special effects heavy, but they're still very like colorful and just sort of like ridiculous in the terms of the plot in a way that's not real. And all the racing sequences, it like gets really fast and gets really psychedelic, and like you got these streaks and it's like obviously not real. So it doesn't really, I think it's maybe, you know, their sort of turn to being more like spy movies, being more surveillance is not always fun. They, you know, but it is to me interesting at least to see how they've like adapted and how they've, because it's the rare series that has been going on for 20 years now. and has adapted to a lot of different trends in blockbuster filmmaking.
Yeah, and it's also just, I don't, you know, I saw people kind of talking about it a little bit, like ahead, like leading up to the movie, and then a little after, and it's, you know, I don't know. Also, I'm just like, what do you want, like, out of a big movie?
I don't know.
You know, like, if like this is the one I'm gonna go see it this weekend, but this will be like, for me, like the first multiplex movie that I've seen since, you know, February of last year, and it's, I wanted to go see this one because, like, I don't know why people take it so seriously that it needs to like fit these things and like logic, like, who cares? Mm-hmm. Just go and have fun. Like, I don't know. I think the Marvel movies have poisoned our minds when it comes to going to like big movies. Like, these are super fun.
No, and I think that's the thing, is that I was talking to a friend this weekend, who we both saw it, we both really liked it, and both of us were a little bit disappointed in the kind of mixed to middling critical reception that it's had, just because it's like, it just kind of hits a lot of those basic pleasure points of like various kinds of spectacle, you know, just like, and it's... There's just a loud bang upstairs. It's just like, I guess I just struggled to see, like, if you're like, this isn't believable, this isn't what I want. I don't know what you do want. I mean, maybe you want a really gritty car movie, which, that's fine. Like, go watch fucking Tulane Blacktop. Like, don't, like, why are you watching Fast and Furious? I don't know. It's just like, it's not honestly, like, it is, again, there is a mounting sort of like sense of like, how do we top ourselves? You know, it's like Pixar with stunts, basically. Like, we were talking about, it's like, you know, I think maybe some people, the one-upmanship doesn't really work for them. But for me, at least in this movie, I think it definitely did work. It's a weird movie to say, like, I don't want to spoil, because it's like, there are, I guess, you know, it's, you know, there's cameos and characters coming back and some twists and stuff that I wouldn't want to spoil, just because it's really fun to see, especially for long-running fans of the movies. But just like, I mean, part of it, you couldn't even really spoil the big set pieces and stuff, because how do you really explain that in a way that compares to seeing it? But there's just some kind of like stunts, you know, like where things go and how a situation gets solved, which, that's ultimately what these movies are about, is what I've realized is that they're about like faith. Both, there's like a kind of, I mean, obviously there's the sort of religious subtext of like forgiveness, you know, like everybody who's a villain in these movies basically gets redeemed and brought into the fold of the family. But also, so many times, there are so many set pieces across these films where a car, somebody just drives a car into the air and prays that like something will swing into their field of vision, or that they will happen to like shift a gear at the right time and spin into a building or latch onto a crane or I don't know what. But it's just literally time and again, people just drive off of a ledge and say, God, I hope this fucking happens. You know, I hope we get through this. And they do. And there is a sort of running joke in this movie specifically with Tyrese, where he's like, there's a couple times where he like gets out of a scrape, you know, it gets out, almost dies, and he's like, I don't have a scratch on me, like, what's going on? Like, surely, like, there must, it's almost like Unbreakable with Tyrese, where he's like, why are we still alive? Like, is there some other reason? And so the movie's kind of playing with you in that regard of like, are these people actually maybe like superheroes? But obviously it's, you know, it's Tyrese's like the comic relief in these movies and the butt of every joke. And so, you know, you're not supposed to actually believe that, but it does know what it's doing. I saw somebody compare it to like, it's the, say that it's like the Moonraker of Fast and Furious, which, I will say that it is more true than you might expect, but I do think that it's just like, I you know, these movies have become, like I said earlier, spy movie, surveillance, action in a lot of different ways than they were originally, but they've always been about technology, you know, just their car movies, and they've always been about these cars that are like on the exterior classic muscle cars, but then on the inside they have nitrous, they have computers, you know, hard drives, and it's about this sort of like meeting of of, I mean, you know, obviously those are two kinds of technology, but we talk about metal and gears in a different way than computers. And we talk about, you know, real air quotes stunts that people do physically, but are still faked in some way differently than like CGI special effects. But those are still the same kinds of tools. And so that these movies are really about those things, like working together about, I mean, they're kind of in some ways about like special effects. Like, I feel like, because what is a car, but like sort of a special effect, you know?
Yeah. I feel like there's just like this kind of, I feel like people are harder on these movies than like other things. And like, it's like, well, they're preposterous. And you're like, yeah, but like, do you really want to watch like a big movie on a big screen that's logical? Like, why would you want to watch a logical movie? Like, that would just be boring. It just makes no sense to me. Like, I feel like it's a line that they draw for it that's unfair.
Well, I think too, it's like, this is purely like, when you're talking about blockbuster movies, this is like down to the heart of why people watch movies. I mean, obviously there's a very deep relationship that you have with these characters, but it's very different than the relationship of a Marvel fan to Marvel characters, which is honestly, you know, Fast and Furious has, this one has John Cena, previous ones have had The Rock, but the Marvel is a little bit honestly more like wrestling, where it's about like combinations of characters. It's ultimately about this like parasocial relationship between fans and the characters, and like, whoa, Iron Man and Captain America are fighting. And there's an element of that in these movies. There is a little bit of, whoa, you know, people are turning on each other. Oh, now they're friends. Whoa. But it's still more about like the presence of the actual actors, I think, in a kind of earthy, very spectacle way. And it's also, again, it's just like, it's fast cars. Like, it's explosions, it's momentum, it's intensity. It's just like all of these just very sort of basic elemental cinematic experiences, and that's why people go to it. They don't go to it because, you know, a kid doesn't go to a Fast and Furious movie necessarily because they saw a toy on a shelf or because they saw a Happy Meal. They go to it because they're like, whoa, things on the screen, sounds, and that's why it's perfect for going back to the movies.
Yeah.
It's just like
explosions,
pure cinema, stripped down.
Yeah,
souped
like,
up.
Like people went to, you know, the Lumiere brothers to watch the train. You know, they had the train going at, like, that's on the same level as this. Like, you know, it's like Buster Keaton blew up a train in The General because it's cool, and it was, you know, like, you want to entertain people. Like, I don't,
also I will say, sorry to butt in, but I just kind of recall, like, I think that it's especially frustrating for people to be like, this isn't realistic enough, because there is like very like a kind of they bring in a real racing subculture in the way that they haven't really in a little bit, where there's this whole flashback, like a third of the movie is like Vin Diesel's teenage years, and is a story of like his father, who is like a stock car driver, dying in like a fiery wreck, and this kind of origin story of Vin Diesel and then his long lost brother, played by John Cena, and so it has this sort of like, it brings it back to racing and to cars in a way it maybe hasn't in a little bit, and it still gets into very ridiculous territory, John Cena in basically a jetpack like zip lining across London, but again, it's still, I think it still has this sort of core. And just really quick before we wrap up on the note of John Cena, I think it's very notable, I think it's a very, it's a landmark in his career a little bit, because unlike The Rock, you know, the most successful, most famous wrestler turned Hollywood actor, The Rock started his career as a heel, as a villain. Foul-mouthed, awful, rude. Then he eventually was so popular that he became a face, became a hero. And then in Hollywood has mostly kind of played this sort of babyface hero. I mean, earlier in his career, maybe a little bit less so, but this is his persona now, is like family-friendly. John Cena has never been allowed to turn heel. He has always, in his time as the face of WWE, as the franchise, he has always, always, always been the ultimate babyface. He has never been bad. He has never had an ounce of villain in his body. until now. And this movie is like his heel turn and is him, I think, showing himself as a performer in a different way. And, you know, he doesn't get quite as much to do as I expected, I'll be honest. But he does do a lot of mean mugging. His chin does a lot of work, and it leaves the book wide open for him to come back much more in future movies. And again, it's just cool to see him, just as a wrestling fan, but also as just an action movie fan and a fan of movie stars. It's just kind of cool to see that development of somebody who has been so associated with, like, the good guy, the funny guy, you know, the dad, to make this sort of villainous departure and to switch his career up. So
no, I'm excited, and I'm just, I don't know. It just confounds me. Like, listening to, like, the discourse around it. Like, it's just like, I don't know. Like, I hate the phrase, like, well, this was preposterous, but I'm like, yeah, like, movies should all be preposterous. They're fucking movies. Like, come on. That's my feeling.
Yeah, I don't, if a movie's trying too hard to convince me that it's real, I start to get suspicious.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get into that probably in part two, because, they very much wanted this movie to be something deep, like a realistic experience, not, you know, it's deep, but it very much wanted to be a realistic experience. But F9 is in theaters now. I think, I haven't seen it, but I'm going to go ahead and recommend, like, going to the movie theater to go see it, because that sounds super fun. Oh, yeah. Like go to the giant screen. Like, hell yeah. Like, it seems like a great time. I'm super excited to do that this weekend. But yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with 1924's Greed after this. Hello, Cinematary. This is Zach, your host, and I'm going to use this midpoint in this week's episode to let you know a little bit about what's happening on both the website and the podcast. So first off, I know for a very long time we asked you not to give us any money. Well, things have changed. We want that money. I'm just kidding. We just want like $5 a month for the rest of your life. But we're doing a Patreon, and I promise this is all in good fun. Patreon.com/cinematary. I'm sure you've heard us mention it at the end of the episode. We are doing this in order to pay for our writing that is happening on the website. We have a wonderful breadth of writers who are all giving a lot of time and effort to come up with reviews and share their thoughts on the website. And so we wanted to just give back to them in that way. And so that is why we created our Patreon page. So again, for $5 a month, you can get exclusive content from the staff. Right now we have our hit series Film Theory and Chill, which takes a piece of film theory each month and then deconstructs it in a way that makes it a little bit more accessible. And then we end that episode usually with just us rambling about whatever is on our mind at that period of time. It's for some people, I guess. but you can find that on patreon.com/cinematary. Please consider, you know, making that donation each month just to help show these writers your appreciation for what they do. Another easy way to kind of keep up with what's happening on Cinematary is signing up for our free newsletter. So if you missed an episode, if you weren't paying attention to social media and you missed maybe a review or something, or a video essay or something that we posted, this is an easy way to keep up with all of that. So each Sunday we send out a note. It goes straight to your inbox. It gives you the latest podcast episodes, you know, what's happening on the Patreon page, and the last two reviews that are on cinematary.com. This is a great way to keep up with what's happening, and it's a nice way if you forget to go, oh, hey, I'm not, you know, just chilling out on a Sunday. I'm having some coffee, doing Sunday things. Here, I'm going to check out what Andrew wrote about something, or what Nathan wrote about something. Just, you know, we got that stuff going. So you can find that on the website, cinematary.com. You can sign up for the newsletter. Again, it's free. And finally, the easiest way to support this show is to go on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and give us a rating and review. You know, this is just how the algorithms work. I know every show asks you to do this, but honestly, if you could take, 30 seconds to a minute and do this, it would greatly, you know, help us. I mean, this helps us just as much as, you know, signing up for the Patreon or letting people know on social media that you listen to Cinematary and you enjoy it. All of that stuff is very helpful. So give us a rating or review on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to the podcast, and, you know, share it on social media. Let people know that Cinematary is around. So again, consider donating to Patreon. That's patreon.com/cinematary. Sign up for the free newsletter and then give us a rating and review on your podcaster app. Well, that is way too much of me talking. You're about to hear more of me talking, so I apologize in advance. But thank you for listening, and let's get back to the show. And we're back with part two of episode 358 of Cinematary. In this part, we will be kicking off our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with 1924's Greed. Written and directed by Eric von Stroheim and based on the book McTeague, which was written by Frank Norris. The film, it's about when a housewife, Trina McTeague, wins the lottery. Her comfortable life with her dentist husband, John, is slowly destroyed, in part by her own increasing paranoia and in part by the machinations of a villainous friend, Marcus, which, side note, I didn't realize was her cousin.
Really?
Yeah, I was.
Because weren't they going to get married at the beginning of the movie?
Yeah, so honestly, that's good that she went to McTeague because you don't want to be marrying your cousin. Anyway, you know. So
it was, but your rich cousin, though? I don't know.
Yeah, your cattle rustling cousin? Oh, yeah. So director Eric von Stroheim shot the film on location in and around San Francisco, an extravagance unheard of in the 1920s. The blue book of the screen for 1924 contained an article called Realism that discussed von Stroheim's obsession with filming Greed on location at or near the places that Frank Norris described in the book. The article stated that, quote, not one single scene was produced or filmed in the studio, and having first envisioned filming the book a decade earlier against its original background, von Stroheim scouted locations with his production manager and technical director 2 months before production began, and much of the story took place at a downtown building on Polk Street in San Francisco, where McTeague had both his dental parlor and the living quarters, but that part of the city had burned down following the 1906 earthquake, and so von Stroheim literally went searching through the surviving neighborhoods and found and leased a late 19th century building that, quote, fitted in exact detail with the building that the author Frank Norris described. So von Stroheim considered Greed to be a Greek tragedy in which environment and heredity controlled the characters' fates and reduced them to primitive human beast, a naturalistic concept in the vein of Zola.
Oh my God. Yeah.
On why the film should be made, he said, quote, I intended to show men and women as they are all over the world, none of them perfect, with their good and bad qualities, their noble and idealistic sides, and their jealous, vicious, mean, and greedy sides. I was not going to compromise. I felt that after the last war, the motion picture going public had tired of the cinemagraphic chocolate eclairs, which...
Yeah, that's exactly what I want after, like, World War One. Horrifying war is to just suffer at the movies.
Yeah, exactly. So he said the chocolate eclairs, which had been stuffed down their throats and which had in a large degree figuratively ruined their stomachs with this overdose of saccharose and pictures. Now, I felt they were ready for a large bowl of plebeian but honest corned beef and cabbage. Von Stroheim's obsession for realism became a problem in Death Valley itself. So according to an article in the January 1925 Motion Picture Magazine, which was called Through Death Valley with von Stroheim, the director was warned by the studio and its insurance company to avoid filming in the hottest and most hospitable place in the United States, where thousands of prospectors and explorers and people had died there over the years. And so von Stroheim reportedly told the executives, quote, do you think that to make this picture, I'll drag some sand into the studio, put my actors before the camera, and say, you're out in a desert, old chappy, frightfully uncomfortable, you know, you're dying of heat and thirst, tarantulas are crawling over you, look the part, old fellow, register agony. He demanded that his cast and crew, quote, follow McTeague's flight into Death Valley. To get an establishing shot, the crew scaled Sheep's Mountain to a spot 8,000 feet above the desert floor. Then they entered Death Valley over the immigrant trail in the scene where they have the fight to the death between McTeague and Marcus was filmed at, quote, it's called, I guess, the sink, which is the lowest spot on Earth not covered with water. It's 337 feet below sea level in the month of August. So, and then since Death Valley was, like, the well water was poisonous because of arsenic, because of the heat and just the conditions, an airplane had to drop a cast iron tank of water down to, like, you know, keep them alive. And then because it was so hot and people were, like, going crazy, they had two armed men that guarded the water. So that's just kind of...
Talk about greed.
Exactly, right? So the final scenes were filmed at the Big Dipper gold mine in Placer County, where von Stroheim cinematically captured how rocks were crushed and gold was extracted. And then while shooting there, the cast and crew of 93 men were pressed into service by the fire marshal because there was a huge forest fire approaching the mine. So he shot approximately 85 hours of footage before editing, and his original version, which was has since been lost, ran for nearly 10 hours. In the November 10th, 1923 camera, von Stroheim blamed his mania for faithfully recreating the novel cinematically on the press and the viewing public, which routinely criticized Hollywood's, quote, mutilation of literature. He continued, I decided to make an absolutely literal film transposition of a novel that has been accepted as a classic of American literature.
Ah, yes, McTeague, that classic. we all read today.
You're reading in schools, yeah. He made Greed, quote, without a single important change except for the title. I made it so that it could be said, as Norris wrote it, so von Stroheim produced it. He promised to give up filmmaking if the public did not like the movie. The same article reported that he, quote, barricaded himself in his cutting room at the Goldwyn Studios, where he worked 16 hours at a time, and he reduced his initial 42 reels of film to 24 reels and then refused to cut anymore. His friend, director Rex Ingram, further edited the film to 18 reels, and then June Mathis then reduced the film to 10 reels and added new titles. And they ended up earning credits as film editors. So after nearly 2 years of in production, Greed was made its world premiere in December 4th, 1924, and William Randolph Hearst leased to MGM because he felt it was, quote, absolutely the most powerful motion picture he had ever seen. So there's your nice review from Hearst. In his final years, von Stroheim said that, quote, of all my films, only Greed was a fully realized work, and only Greed had a total validity. In 1926, a British Foundation of Arts and Sciences requested a copy of the original version of the film to keep in their archive, but the request was denied by MGM. Henry Langlois screened the studio version of Greed for von Stroheim in 1950, and he said, quote, it was for me an exhumation. It was like opening a coffin, which there was just dust giving off a terrible stench, a couple of vertebra, and a piece of shoulder bone. He went on to say that, quote, it was as if a man's beloved was run over by a truck, maimed beyond recognition. He goes to see her in the morgue. Of course he still loves her, but it's only the memory of her that he can love because he doesn't recognize her anymore. This guy seems like a trip. The New York Journal called Greed, quote, an epic of almost ruthless realism. It is a remarkable picture. The New York Daily News deemed it one of the most conspicuous pictures of all time. And Photoplay in 1925 said, quote, greed is sordid, greed is depressing, greed is brutal, greed is shocking. It reeks with good acting and wonderful direction. Von Stroheim has emphasized the detail of a sordid story until it becomes almost repulsive. It is the realism of vulgarity to the nth degree, and that is art. Von Stroheim has produced a masterpiece. So on that giant note, I guess let's dig into Greed. What did you all I want to just mention for the listeners before we dig into it that we watched the 2 hour and 10 minute cut that is available on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Now this cut does not have any music
whatsoever
in it, so it is completely silent. We'll talk about that in a minute, but I guess Michael, let's start with you. What did you make of Greed?
I liked it. You know, I'm surprised at that quote about like how this was supposed to be, I don't remember the food, but the gruel basically, because I was watching it and I was like, wow, this movie just is moving. Like it was, and I guess it's because we're watching like essentially 1/4 of like the original cut. But I remember thinking like, this reminds me a lot of like the Treasure of the Sierra Madre, in the sense of like, you get like this kind of it's not a MacGuffin, but like, you know, kind of the initial conflict having to do with characters want something. And from that, they just like spin out in all their worst impulses. And like, I mean, maybe this is just like, you know, looking in like, you know, 95 years of hindsight. But it was like pretty entertaining for me to watch like these characters' lives spin out of control. Like, I mean, I can imagine it being bleak, but also because the movie moves so quickly through these plot points, it just felt like I was being just like pulled through this really extravagant and like wild story. Like the guy at the beginning of the movie that is apparently her cousin, you know, who wants to marry her, doesn't get to marry her, and then he goes off and becomes a cattle rustler. Like, it's just like really wild, like tossed off bits like that that are just like, whoa. And then he doesn't show up for like an hour or something, and then he shows up again and does like wild things. And I guess like,
and also like disappears and is like, fuck you, McTeague, I'm gonna fuck over your life, and then leave. And then he leaves for an hour.
Yeah, and then he comes back and he does. He fulfills his promise. And I don't know, the movie's just full of stuff like that. And like, I can imagine that being like really bleak and oppressive if I were in the right mindset and maybe watching 9 hours of it. But at like just a little bit over 2 hours, like it honestly was like engaging and entertaining, even though it's like pretty bleak, but entertaining the way that like kind of film noir tends to be entertaining, in the sense of like watching people's like worst impulses can be really just gripping at times. It was also, I mean, you mentioned that it being completely silent, you know, that was, I considered putting on my own music in the background, but that was a little bit rough. I don't know if I would have rather the like copy paste ragtime stuff that like a lot of these YouTube rips have, but it was, I don't know, there's got to be a better experience than silent 2.5 hours.
Yeah, that's how it screens at Anthology Film Archives in New York, is completely silent.
Is that like with all silent films or specifically this one?
That is actually, I guess it is like most, but I think that like certain things that had like a specific score written for them, they do.
Have you been to one of those?
So the only fully silent film I've seen there is actually Dog Star Man, which there was a, we did an episode about it a few years ago, but there was a fire drill, or not a fire drill, like the fire alarm went off, but there wasn't, I guess there was, I guess, I don't know what happened, but it was just a weird movie to be interrupted during, but also it was very hard to like be in a physical space with other people and have silence. And I guess the thing maybe about like, I mean, seeing something like Greed in the 1920s, I'm sure the audience would feel a lot more free to like just be normal and like make noise like people probably would have at that time. But if you're seeing Greed in 2020, you know, in the 2020s, like people are gonna be very respectful and they're gonna be very still and quiet. And I feel like it's an odd thing, because like, I don't know, you know, like there's always some kind of noise, even if a movie is like truly silent, like, and so sometimes like just everybody sitting there like trying to be silent is very weird to me. And I feel like I would rather just like people be quote unquote disrespectful to the movie. And like, I don't know, there's something about like Greed, like where, I mean, it feels a little bit like, I think maybe just, it's just like how much sort of kind of there is that happens, and how, like you were saying, Michael, that speed it with which it moves through plot points. But, you know, it has an almost like televisual kind of in terms of narrative, like, you know, that, I don't know, that sort of like serialized style, I guess like of that era. It feels like, you know, it does feel very much like an adaptation, or like, you know, it just has so much sort of like, you know, I don't know, imagine somebody sitting down trying, like, writing this as a movie not being adapted from something. It's just, like, has this kind of storytelling quality that I can imagine at the time would have been probably pretty jarring. or not. I don't know. It's just sort of, it's totally hypothetical, but it is kind of interesting to think about, like, what it would have been like to be a viewer in 1924 and to see something like this. I mean, obviously there's a lot of big, you know, dense narrative movies before this and Griffith and stuff, but this does feel like another sort of level of, like, I don't know. I think of something like, I mean, stuff like Birth of a Nation and Intolerance, like, they have characters, but it's more like the grand sweep of history. And this is, like, much more like, this is a study of characters over time and the corrosion of their lives. And I feel like that kind of character investment feels a little bit new. Like, these are real people and not an ensemble or symbols or, like, archetypes of, you know.
Yeah, and, like, because the movies that I've seen that, like, it's very influential to is like, the one that, Michael, you mentioned, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, but also, like, Jonathan Rosenbaum has talked about, like, how he sees a lot of, like, Orson Welles' stuff, specifically, yeah, like, the Magnificent Ambersons in this. I really liked, he made this really interesting comparison to this and Mikey and Nikki, the Elaine May movie, and talking about, like, how it's that, like, that movie is also a movie about, like, the disintegration of a friendship over money and sex. And like, that was kind of a good, like, leaping off point for me, like, trying to kind of make sense of the movie, because it's true, like both of those movies, or all three of those movies specifically, which I all three really like as well, it's to your point, Nadine, it's not about like archetypes working. It is like this slow, like, kind of trickling down of just, like, an erosion of a person, you know, like you think of, like, the Joseph Cotton character in Magnificent Ambersons, or John Cassavetes in Mikey and Nikki, or Humphrey Bogart in Treasure of Sierra Madre. It's not like there's, like, a switch that turns on and they immediately, like, turn evil. It's just, it just slowly erodes. And, like, that's the kind of thing with this one, where McTeague is, it's not like he has, like, the whole eruption at the beginning where he pushes somebody off a cliff and kills them. So you would think that, like, oh, well, the switch is turned on really easily, but it's just kind of like this slow trickle down erosion, and in like the way that von Stroheim uses the camera and, like, that deep focus cinematography, and, like, doesn't really, like, telegraph anything. Yeah, it's very different from, like, Griffith, who is very telegraphy, who's very explicitly giving you how to feel in these scenes. Like, von Stroheim is very much, like, hands off, and I can see why somebody like an Orson Welles would be, like, infatuated by this.
Yeah, I think that, like, you mentioned Orson Welles, and I thought of, with the Birdcage, I don't know, it felt like a Rosebud, like, device. Like, that was really, like, what I thought of. And just that sort of similar, like, it feels both like a movie that is summing up a lot of what has come before, but is also very deliberately trying to push ahead in the way that I think Welles was also kind of trying to do. And with that, it rides this line between, like, a kind of artifice and that reality that is just captured in the insanity of von Stroheim that you summed up, Zach, where, like, he is really trying to capture some kind of reality or verisimilitude, whatever that is, whether in terms of location or character or behavior. And that's, it's really just interesting to think about everything that, like, comes from that. And I read something, I think it was just, like, on the Wikipedia page, but it talked about how a lot of the people who were real fans and champions of this movie early on were, like, other filmmakers, like Welles, and Chaplin, I think, was also a big fan. And I mean, all of these people are, like, sort of, great, acclaimed, beloved auteurs, but people in terms of the actual, like, specifics of their career had a really fucking difficult time getting stuff made, and oftentimes had these very audacious, ambitious projects, not quite maybe to this level, but up there that were not understood, and that sort of form. I mean, this movie, to me, part of why I you know, was a little bit interested in putting it forward as a contender for the series this year was, you know, it's on so many lists and mentioned so much, and I feel like it's not just formative in terms of like just filmmaking, but almost like film studies, I feel like, comes from this movie in a way, and cinephilia comes from this movie in a way, where so much of that like study of film is rooted in the idea of like the film maudit, the cursed film, you know, like almost that quote of like, you know, finding a coffin, a dusty coffin. It's like, what went wrong in film history? What was actually like important? What is the hidden history, dredging that up, but also the idea of like this movie literally opens and it says personally directed by Eric von Stroheim. Like the whole
idea, the
idea of like, I mean, and he's adapting a book. The idea of like director as author, as auteur, kind of begins here, I think, really. I mean, you can say like Griffith, whatever, but I think there's a self consciousness in like here that like Griffith was doing stuff, but I think he was just like an industry craftsman, and this is like a little bit different, and like somebody is thinking of themselves as an artist.
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, you think of you know, like how Griffith or somebody like a John Ford kind of approach their filmmaking, even though we view them as auteurs or in a sense that way now, like they weren't actively thinking of themselves like that. But then you think of like how von Stroheim is approaching this, or how Orson Welles approached his stuff. Like there is just kind of this difference in like the way that the filmmakers worked. And honestly, like, I don't know if I'll watch this again. I might watch it again. I don't know if I'll watch it again though. But at the same time, it's been one of the most fascinating movies in a while to just think about, to completely to your point, because there's just so many, like, there's so many facets just like within the movie. It's incredibly interesting. But then just like all the stuff that that's why I spent so long on the note sheet, because there was so much stuff outside of it. And like, to me, that's amazing, because like, that's what's so interesting about movies, is that you have like this product on the screen, and that is that, you know, you have that, but you also had all this crazy shit that was happening on the outside. I mean, like, they're in Death Valley with like, they're having to get airlifted water and have people like guard the water, and they're supposed to like live in this, and like what you're seeing on screen is like all of those elements all like swirled up all together and then just tossed into the scene. And like, you think of like that whole like last fight between McTeague and Marcus, and like, it's just insane. It's just incredible to think about that. Like, just like all of that perspective put into that final confrontation, and him just sitting there, like looking at the money and letting the bird go, and the bird just kind of plops down. Like, it's just that whole sequence. Like, it's just like so, it's so insanely moving and fascinating when you just think of all that was put up leading up to that.
I think, like, based on like what, like the behind the scenes stuff, and like what you're talking about, like Griffith versus Ford, and or Griffith and Ford versus von Stroheim, is like, based on like the stuff that you read at the top, Zach, von Stroheim like consciously viewed himself as an artist in spite of the studio machinery, whereas the other two were artists within the studio machinery. And like, I know auteur theory would be that like, even within like the machinations of the studio, artistry arose from particular voices. But I don't know, like, to y'all's point, like Griffith and Ford and, you know, several other of those people, you know, that we would kind of mention as like the early, like, you know, kind of directors, they were very clearly working like in the same direction as the studio machinery, and were able to, you know, produce artistry from that. Whereas von Stroheim is conscious of the fact that his artistry lies in
a contradiction. Little too conscious.
Yeah. I mean, some of that stuff that you read like diminishes the movie in a certain way for me, because like, I was thinking like, this is like, you know, a pretty great time, like a great ride. And like the fact that he conceived of it as like this uber serious, like epic, like kind of makes me feel like that, like he was high on his own supply a little bit.
I think he was.
But like at the same time, like it is really interesting in the same way that like, you know, Orson Welles or whatever, you mentioned Magnificent Ambersons, you know, which of course famously has the original cut lost as well. But I was thinking also about Citizen Kane, where like the making of that movie involved them literally like cutting pieces out of the studio floor and stuff like that. Like, you know, the movie that we saw came out of direct opposition to the soundstage design and parameters of the, you know, kind of conventional studio tools. And him going like on location shooting, Von Stroheim, like, feels like a precursor to that, where he's saying like the traditional boundaries of like what the studio picture allows me are insufficient. And so I have to like find a way to subvert those in some way. And I think that like, when we think about like, you know, quote unquote, like auteurs now, like I think the original intent was like, you know, of that word was, oh, these are people with a really strong voice. And that voice creates interesting, like, you know, artistry, despite the like formulaic studio trappings. But I think like, as we view it now, it is those like directors who see a way out of, or a way to subvert like formula, you know, like when, you know, people talk about like, I don't know, whatever, like the big auteur, like Tarantino or someone like that, like the things people like are the things that they perceive as either like in the tradition of older Hollywood, but also things that subvert it. Like, you know, Marvin getting shot in Pulp Fiction or like things like that. Like those are the things that people latch onto and think like, wow, this is a person who is different. And I feel like that's kind of like the modern conception of like the kind of rogue auteur director is someone who is like subversive of like formula in some way. And this feels like a precursor to that in a lot of ways.
Well, I also think there's like that, there's just like the, you know, the now obviously, I mean, for a long time there've been detractors of auteur theory and that kind of idea of auteurism, because people say, oh, you know, like it's a collaborative medium and there are a lot of different voices and a lot of different hands involved, and so you can't just put all the credit on one person, which I think the sort of counter to that usually is like, oh, well, that's like not the original intent. You know, the original intent is sort of just sort of identifying these people, like you're talking about, Michael, that have been sort of covered up by how the industry works and how things are supposed to go. You know, things aren't supposed to stand out. It's supposed to be formula. So I think initially there was that sort of idea of like, let's point at someone and be like, yes, this is like an author. This is a coherent voice, a style, a shared series of attributes across a series of different movies. And then at some point it became this like badge of quality, you know, of like, this person, you know, is thinking of themselves as an author and as the person in control of their movie and as the distinct voice behind it, not the cinematographer or the screenwriter or the best boy or whatever. You know, it's the director. And
best boy should be the auteur.
Yeah. And I feel like, like, you know, like, obviously that's, I think the criticisms are totally valid, because I do think that that leads into these sort of portraits of mad genius that tends to be abusive and exploitative. I mean, I think that like you see here a little bit of the prototype for like similar movies about madness, like Apocalypse Now or Fitzcarraldo, where the directors kind of got a taste of the medicine of what the film was about. Like, just, you know, the sort of tale that gets told of kind of everything going to hell on the set of Apocalypse Now in the Philippines, and Fitzcarraldo obviously being about this guy who's trying to drag a ship up a hill, and then Werner Herzog tries to actually drag a ship up a hill and people get killed. And, you know, you do with that what you will, whether or not that's the cost, you know, of art, you know, that's up to you. But I think it's just like, it's just, you know, it's interesting how this is a movie that is about just like people spiraling out of control, and like the behind the scenes story is a little bit of like of that. But it's just interesting that this is a movie where Von Stroheim's intention was to try to capture reality in a way that it hadn't before, but it just ends up bringing up more and more contradictions of like what is real and what is artificial about cinema. Because obviously, like, yes, you're going to Death Valley because that is the place that you are setting the film, but you're also having to airlift in a tank of water. Like, that's not reality, you know, like, and you're just kind of pretending that that's not there. So it does just sort of, you know, raise all of these thorny questions. But I also just wonder too, like, you know, would it have been a visual shock almost to see a movie shot on location like this? I mean, just thinking, as we've kind of been talking more and more, you know, I was just thinking about like Griffith's movies and just like basically any silent movie I've seen that is so bound to a set. And I mean, I, you know, if that's all you've seen, if all of you've seen are movies that are shot on a studio backlot, like that's what movies are to you. I don't know. Would it really stand out of like, this is the desert? Like what? Like,
yeah,
they're really there, you know?
That's a good point, because you think about like, you think about like a Ford movie, like a lot of the, like what you get out of it is, you know, how they film Monument Valley, you know, like how that, you know, you're not in Culver City backlot, you're in Monument Valley. Or, you know, you look at like a Chaplin film, you know, he has his own studio with United Artists that he's kind of created. It's still sets, like he's in charge of it, and he's getting to form them, but there's still sets. And what if he, you know, was filming on location in the streets of London that, you know, inspired that? You know, what if he was filming, you know, filming like the kid in London rather than filming it on the studio lot? You know, would that have made a difference? You know, I don't know. But yeah, I think that just seeing like, you know, seeing the San Francisco area on screen in that way probably made a massive difference to audiences in 1924.
I don't know how much of this has to do with, because obviously we don't know what this movie looked like as far as like how long the shots are and like, you know, which shots are in it, you know, because we don't have, you know, we didn't watch 75% of this movie. One thing that struck me compared to like other silent films, silent dramas, you know, as opposed to like comedy specifically, is that like this movie is a lot less reliant on like those kind of tableaus. You know, like you think about like Intolerance or something, and like the big like Babylon thing, and that sort of thing is really only possible in to the scale that it's often done on a state, like on a soundstage in some way. And I wonder if filming on location had them like, you know, you have to shoot in a different way, and that results in just different film language compared to some of the peers. I don't know that for a fact. I'm just kind of musing on that, like, you know, when I think about how does this movie look different from other like you know, kind of silent epics that I've seen, and that is one thing that strikes me, is I can't think of very many of those big, like, you know, you kind of have the camera a long ways away from whatever's happening, and the goal is to like take in all this visual information before the next like intertitle or something like that. That doesn't seem to be nearly as much at play in this one. And maybe that's just due to like the narrative stuff as well, like it being focused on characters as opposed to more, you know, these kind of like literally epic, like sized stories. Like this isn't an epically sized story. And so maybe the camera would be more focused on the individuals anyway, regardless of whether it was in a studio or on location. But I remember that kind of striking me too, like how close and at times claustrophobic this movie is compared to some other silent films.
Yeah, and I think with that, it's like the acting style is sometimes a little bit more restrained and subdued than I think that like people normally associate with that kind of like, I don't know, the parody of sort of like silent cinema overacting. I mean, I think that what he is just trying to do in terms of location shooting also sort of applies to the sort of performance style and the look of the characters even. where, I don't know, McTeague is just like very physically kind of distinctive and sort of has a very kind of gritty look.
Imposing. He's very imposing. Yeah. You know, like you think of him in like the dentist clothes, like he doesn't look like he should be a dentist. He looks like he should be like a heavyweight fighter. And there's something there's like a dissonance there.
I mean, he is like a minor at the beginning, he right? Is. Like, yeah. So he's, I don't know. Dentistry is really interesting because it like went from being this extremely physical profession to being more like a professional, like white collar profession. Cause like, dentists used to be like, I mean, in the old days, it would be like, the metal workers, like blacksmiths and things like that would do like dentistry as well.
I mean, I guess the only thing then was just rip it out. Like,
yeah, I guess so.
There's really nothing else to do usually.
Yeah. It was something. Cause you know, I was thinking a lot like about McTeague, like in the early scenes of this. And I was thinking about a conversation we had a couple weeks ago. Aster and Logan were talking about Dave Bautista in Army of the Dead and like how he's like, I remember Logan kind of describing him as like, you know, Dave Bautista's like this very, you know, he's a wrestler. He's this big, you know, super strong guy who's just kind of like this just large presence. But he like is playing like this very kind of introspective, almost character, like very, you know, to a degree, gentle character, you know, people have mentioned like his glasses and stuff, but like he is kind of like this gentle character, even though he's like this giant macho, like, action star persona in that movie. And I was thinking about like McTeague kind of in that realm as well. Like he reminds me of like kind of the wrestlers turned actors where he just feels like this very imposing large figure that's kind of like trying to fit into this this persona, at least kind of early on. And then he starts to lose that as he starts to lose it. But we're talking about him. I'm trying to think of the actor. The actor's name is Gibson Gowland. Like he's just like this very, I don't know. He's just a very interesting. And then you have Zazu Pitts, who is like this very thin. Like whenever he starts getting abusive toward her, like there is like this, there's this fear in the scene, not just because it's like this you know, this man being abusive to this woman, but also it's like this hulking figure and there's just this tiny woman that you know, whenever she like kind of cowers to him and she like her eyes like get so large, there's almost like this expressionistic quality to like the fear in those scenes that I found to be like I don't see that type of visual in it with fear when it comes to like a Griffith movie or something like that. Any final thoughts on greed? I mean, I think that there's, I don't know, like I feel like we could probably go on for a while just talking about just the insanity of a lot of this, but I don't know, if to me again, like it is kind of, it's like it's a test to watch. It is kind of it's pretty tough to watch, not just because of the subject matter, but also just because, like we talked about, it's a wholly silent movie and it's 2 hours and 10 minutes long. But I'm glad that we watched it. I think it is, like, it's definitely something that I think should be investigated more by people, especially those who are interested in like the early days and like the formation of American movies.
I think it is worth mentioning like that if you are going to seek this out, there are at least two basic like cuts that you can watch, which is the one we watched, and then the 4-hour restoration, which was not completely restored, and they've apparently put still images where the missing footage is, and I have no idea how the movie plays like that, and I don't know if I'm curious enough to go watch all 4 hours of that, but I am a little bit curious, given that, like, in its two, like, you know, what was it, like, 140 minutes or whatever that we watched, there, like I mentioned, it feels so quick, and very, like, you know, brutally focused on, like, it's like, characters. But if you read the plot summary on Wikipedia, it's the sprawling plot, not all of which was contained within the cut that we watched. And so I don't know how that would change how I feel about the movie, especially if some of that sprawling plot is told through still images. And so, like, I think, like, this is, I think one of the reasons why this movie remains kind of compelling to modern audiences is there's so many question marks surrounding it, because there's a lot of it that's just, like, permanently out of our reach. And so we're not going to be able to understand, like, you know, this is, you know, you have movies like Blade Runner or whatever, where you can see, like, all the tinkering, you know, you can go back and that's all well documented, like, you know, all the tinkering that's been done. You can kind of see how each of these changes have changed the effect of the movie. But this one, we only have a few different portals into that, and they're so incomplete, so that you have all these really interesting questions that just become kind of philosophical in light of the fact that we have so little of the stuff that makes those questions come up. So I don't know. It's really interesting to talk about, I think.
Nadine, any last lingering thoughts on greed?
No. Yeah, it's definitely a bit of a commitment. And you know, it's a bit like walking through Death Valley at times, you know, putting you through the fire. But yeah, it's just like, so I don't know, it just feels like this almost a little bit like, I don't know, the like Dead Sea Scrolls or something. Just like, it feels like it's both this sort of artifact, but it's still very engaging, I think. And just it explains a lot, I think. It's just like, if you are, you know, interested enough in the history of cinema, at least American cinema, and but I think even beyond that, I just feel like it's something where you see it and you're like, oh, like I kind of see the connection between this thing and it, you know, just like putting a piece in the puzzle or something. Like it just, the connections are just, are, you know, not obvious necessarily, but it's just one of those like very formative, influential things where maybe you didn't realize it was so influential. But then it's like, it's just, I don't know, it just unlocks something, I think, watching it. And it just has, in general, whether or not, you know, you struggle with some of the difficult, you know, maybe some of the things that Von Sturm intended to be difficult, I think that it's still just very striking, because it does differ a lot from what people generally assume of silent cinema.
Yeah. No, I agree, and that's why I think it's, you know, again, like I said, if you're interested in exploring the history of like American movies, I think this is one that has to be investigated. You don't necessarily do the 4-hour Ken Burns cut thing, but you can watch the 2-hour 10-minute version on YouTube. all right, well, that will wrap up this episode of Cinematary. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter and Instagram at @cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where you list all the movies that we talked about in this episode. Next week, we'll be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movie series with a 1920s. Let me just stall a little bit. I think it's
1929.
Yeah. 1929's Diary of a Lost Girl. We're going to have a guest on for that one. We're going to be talking with Thomas Gwadish, who is the head of the Lois Brooks Society. Talking a little bit about her. We've talked about Lois Brooks once. We had Pandora's Box on as one of the Young Critics episodes a couple years ago, but we're going to talk a little bit more about her star power as well as like why she's become such a figure of not only silent movies, but Weimar German cinema. So it's going to be kind of I'm excited to hear more about that and talk a little bit about that movie, which also kind of has a history to it. So look forward to that next week. Until then, thank you guys for listening. We'll see you.